Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Jern, Daisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we'll be discussing Sick, which is the latest film from screenwriter Kevin Williamson, who's best known, I think, for co-creating the Scream franchise with Wes Craven. And I would say Sick kind of takes whole chapters out of the Scream playbook, at least structurally, and we'll get into that more during the synopsis. But the basic premise is that it's April 2020, so height of initial COVID lockdown panic, and a pair of college-age women go to quarantine together. Well, not quarantine, because they're not sick, so far as they know, but go to shelter in place or whatever. They call it a cabin, but it's a palatial mansion on a lake that has, you know, like a log facade.
Yeah, it's a prime slasher real estate. You know, it's like The Rental from The Rental, or The House from Hush. It's both remote and mostly windows.
Yeah, that's accurate. Anyway, so they go to this place and then they are attacked by a slasher and shit kind of goes from there. So, Matt, how about you take us away with the synopsis?
We open in 2020 in that most 2020 of locales, a grocery store. A
picked over one.
Yeah, right. With bare shelves, sans toilet paper, and this guy who's got opening scene of a slasher movie, Sacrificial Lamb, written all over him, is wandering around with a face mask on, and he starts getting weird texts from someone asking him if he wants to party, and he goes to stand in the checkout line, and the texts start getting more and more sinister. Eventually, his pursuer texts him a picture of him. You know, the back of his head, basically, standing there in line. He goes out into the parking lot and goes home and is ultimately set upon by a masked slasher who is a little bit of a stooge in the manner of Ghostface, but is not as prone to pratfalls as I would like.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't wipe out and eat shit quite as often as your average Ghostface does. But there's some of that, you know, he's not like a spectral Michael Myers type where he's ninja-ing around. You know, there's some tactility to the altercations here, which I tend to like. I think these days, that's the way to go with slasher movies, is to veer further from the mythical and more towards the plausible. Although, once that gets oversaturated, the pendulum has to swing back the other way. These things always come in waves and cycles and so on. But for what it is, this is pretty decent slasher action. He chases him all over his apartment, which is not palatial, but is big enough to have a series of encounters in.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets slashed up real good. The low point of all this for me was there's an extended period where the victim has been shoved partway through a window. Like, his head and much of his torso is kind of dangling out, and he's fighting with the killer over the knife. And at no point during this phase of the attack does he scream, help me, please God, somebody help me, call the cops, help me. Which is what I would be doing even if my head wasn't sticking out a window. But certainly if it was, I'd be... And, you know, this movie has kind of hackneyed COVID, I don't know what you'd call it, satire sort of baked into it. And that becomes very apparent in the third act. But it's apparent basically from the word go as he's wandering around the grocery store. You know, as he's running out of the grocery store, he bumps into somebody who's like, yo, man, where's your face mask? And it's like, you know.
It's just, like, buddy, he's outdoors. He didn't bump into you at, like, the entry door inside the grocery store. The other thing on the COVID front that bugs me about this movie that sort of wrecks the immersion for me, I guess, for lack of a better word, is that there are way too many of the, like, tailor-made Etsy face masks, you know? 'Cause back, like, 2 weeks into lockdown, people had, if they could get their hands on them, they had the surgical mask types, or they were wearing bandanas and shit. People right. didn't have these specially manufactured cloth style masks. Right. That shit that didn't come out for a couple of months.
That cottage industry was still getting on its feet back in yeah. March and April. Yeah, no, it should be disposables or bandanas and handkerchiefs and shit, like you said.
And gaiters and stuff.
The grocery store scene was that there's this cheerful kind of placid woman's voice constantly piping in saying, you know, remain 6 feet apart at all times. And it's like, this isn't Half-Life 2. I'm sure it varies from one store to the next, one chain to the next, but I don't remember grocery stores being that dystopian, even at the very beginning.
Well, yeah, and not to mention any grocery store that was doing that, it took them a while, just like it took everybody a while to adjust. They didn't spit out these recordings in the space of days to start playing over the PA system. Again, right. all this shit took time. It's just they picked April 2020 and at the beginning of April. I think they put like the third on it or something. Like it was really right there at the outset, basically. I mean, within a couple of weeks, I remember it was mm-hmm. like March 15th, we went into lockdown in Michigan. And I think they just, for what they're doing, maybe I think they might have just picked the wrong date. And as far as the masks thing goes, it might not bother me so much, except for the fact that it's not just in the grocery store where it comes up, because the main character and her friend has one of these custom masks.
Yeah,
and so we see a lot of it all throughout. But as far as the slasher's overall vibe, I agree with you that it's good that they're not a Jason Voorhees or a Michael Myers spectral type. On the other hand, I don't think he has enough of a personality.
Oh, I quite agree.
And I mean, we'll get into this near the tail end. Some stuff comes into play eventually. But the reason for me that the opening scene of Scream works, I mean, for one thing, Wes Craven got Drew Barrymore. And so it's like, wow, this is like a famous person being this sacrificial lamb right up front. That's kind of shocking. And also, you know, there's a whole shtick. I mean, everybody knows how the beginning of Scream plays out. What's your favorite scary movie? They do that whole fucking thing. It's prolonged and you get a very clear sense of Ghostface's whole thing. And here it's just like, all right, we get a look at the slasher in his ninja pajamas or whatever.
He does look like a foot soldier at that. Or a member of the Foot Clan, I mean to say. Fucking Ninja Turtles.
Right. And then he tussles with this guy for a while before killing him. Why the fuck do we care about the victim or the slasher at this point?
Well, we don't. And I brought up the business with him sticking his head out the window in relation to this movie's kind of blinkered take on COVID, because if the movie has the political slant that it has and it's poking fun at the lockdown mentality, and we get a lot of this later on, then when he sticks his head out the window, first of all, the rational thing to do would be to scream your head off. I like to think that's what I would have done were I in his shoes. Secondly, it's a missed opportunity to do a Kitty Genovese thing if that's the angle you're going with, that everyone is scared to death of COVID and it's preventing, at various turns in this movie, it kind of prevents people from being good Samaritans. That could have happened right out of the gate. Help me, please God, someone do something. And no one does, because there's a stay-at-home shelter-in-place order. And so everyone minds their own business. You're on your own, pal. You could have seen blinds closing across the street or whatever. You know, it's just like, he ought to shout. And then, given that this movie is what it is, that ought to have been the result of him shouting, which is to say, no result at all. Instead, they just fumble in the window for a while and then run here and run there and eventually he gets his throat slit. Title drop, and now we meet our actual protagonists, whose names are Parker and Miri.
Mm-hmm.
Miri takes COVID much more seriously. Parker is way more lackadaisical about it, despite having been sick recently. She's shook all her symptoms, and it's all ain't no thing. So the two of them go to the aforementioned Taj Mahal out in the woods, and they settle in. More weirdness to do with the movie not having a firm grasp of what this period of time was actually like. They have already devised like an Anderson Cooper drinking game where they're watching CNN, of all things, just two gal pals in their early to mid-20s hanging out, watching Don Lemon or whoever the fuck. And every time Fauci's name comes up, they take a shot. It's a little weird. It's just to get talking head sound bites in there to kind of reinforce the milieu. But I don't know. Didn't seem to have its finger on the pulse.
Well, but the flip side is we weren't in the demographic that was having lockdown parties.
Perhaps not, no.
And maybe amongst that group, they were doing Fauci drinking games mere weeks in. Who knows? Although the flip side is, like you say, Miri seems to take all this a lot more seriously. I think there's a line which implies that maybe her father is immunocompromised or something. But yeah, then the flip side is, they said Fauci, I'm going to take another shot. Yeah, well, it is a little weird.
This movie has a very short running time, which I like. It does have just the two women in it and another sort of key player who's about to be introduced. But the fact that there's only two of them means it is sort of a binary thing. There's the one who cares about COVID and the one who doesn't. There's no opportunity to establish a spectrum, you know? They don't have a third or a fourth friend chilling in the Taj Mahal. So, yeah, those moments of incongruity do stick out when they break character, so to speak. Doesn't happen often, but they never really come across as real people. The next character who's introduced feels even less like a human being. He is just a fake out to begin with. You are meant to think that the slasher has descended upon the cabin. In point of fact, it's just Parker's on-again, off-again situationship boyfriend, who she's apparently non-exclusive with. And
much to his chagrin, it seems.
Why didn't you announce yourself? And he's like, well, I was on the phone. It's like, well, yeah, okay, we didn't hear you. He acts so shifty that you're meant to wonder if he's in on it, I think. And
maybe,
he very much is not. He's just a bozo. And the job that he's angling for, we hear the tail end of his phone call, is some remote work gig economy bullshit. Which is kind of a graphic design detail thing,
it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, a lot of us were hustling like that in April of 2020, so that was relatively well observed, I think. So he has shown up, obviously unannounced and basically unwanted, although Parker seems a little bit happier to see him than Miri does. And after, well, first they have themselves a bit of a dance party, and then they get a little schwiggity-schwasted, a little stoned, and they're riffing about urban legends. There's something to do with a baby swallowing a snake, and Miri, of course, being the smart one of the two. Again, this is kind of binary characteristics being assigned to them. Miri has to know exactly what folktale, the urban legend, DJ is the dude's name, exactly what folktale the urban legend DJ is blathering about is derived from.
Yeah.
So the filmmakers have the good sense to dispatch DJ first. When the slasher shows up for realsies, he is the first to go. The women escape the cabin. They are idling in the driveway behind the wheels of DJ's truck, or DJ's friend's truck, I think, actually.
Yeah.
And DJ comes out of the cabin with the killer in tow. And in fact, DJ has been partially impaled on a long pole of some kind, and then the killer runs him through the rest of the way, and the women take off in reverse, but they're running on at least one flat. I think they might have been, all the tires might have been slashed, or at least one.
Yeah, I think they're on four flats, and they're so flat that the tires are coming off the wheels while they're trying to maneuver, so they don't get very far. And there's a lot of back and forth in this little stretch, and I didn't get that much of a feeling of suspense out of it, and also it doesn't really come to much of anything. The biggest thing that happens is eventually they end up in some kind of second floor room. It's like an attic, because the door into it is like a hatch almost, but also it's got like a full-size window out over a part of the roof. So it's also kind of not an attic. I don't know, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's like a hobbit apartment or something.
And Parker is trying to lead them walking around on the low part of the roof to get somewhere else. It's not clear what the game plan is. And ultimately, Miri falls off the roof. There's no big wet splat when she hits the ground. It's grass. So we figure, okay, she's probably injured, but we don't assume she's dead at this point. And we later find out she's, in fact, quite alive.
Well, I think this is around the time where Parker sort of cautions her against getting up, tells her to play dead, and then
no, that's kill her. That's a little bit later, I feel like.
Is it? All right. A lot of this blurs together for me. Your assessment of this leg of the journey can kind of be extended to the whole middle stretch of the movie for me, up to and including almost everything, running right up to the big reveal, basically.
Well, I think it starts to resolve itself a little bit when Parker gets out to the dock. There is a 10 or 15 minute stretch in the middle where it's just kind of running around in circles in the house or around the grounds. And yeah, at one point, like you say, it's a little bit later, but she gets over to Miri on the ground and says, you know, yeah, play dead. I don't remember exactly. Is it in this stretch or is it a little later when Parker does some beating down?
I don't know. The killers in this movie take an awful lot of lumps on the head, and they tend to just keep on trucking to a kind of unrealistic degree. And that interferes with the tactility that I was praising earlier.
So, as you may have picked up, there are, in fact, multiple killers. There are two.
Oh, oops. Cat's out of the bag.
Well, no, I was building in that direction anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm already starting to lose a lot of the middle stretch of this movie,
yeah,
like you said.
I feel like I've taken a couple lumps on the head myself.
So, I believe it's before Parker gets out to the dock where she manages to brain the killer. Again, as far as we know, this is the only killer at this point. And gets him on the ground and then sort of climbs on top of him with a big blunt object and just sort of bashes him in the face until we hear a wet crunch. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, there you go. But then not 15, 20 seconds later, another guy in basically the same getup shows up coming through the door. She runs off and then we hear a lot of wailing. About, yeah, okay, I'm remembering it now. We hear a lot of wailing, like, no! Ah! Meanwhile, Parker is outside talking to Miri, who, again, is in fact alive.
Yeah.
But
and this is when she tells her to play possum.
Play possum.
For the water.
Yeah. So Parker runs off. First, she's just kind of in the trees. Miri's possum act almost doesn't work. She, you know, like swallows or something. Not when the guy's looking right at her, but he hears something, and then eventually Parker throws a rock or something and distracts him. Gets out to the dock and manages to grab an oar out of this canoe and whacks him in the face with it. And this is the second time that one of the protagonists gets a good whack in on somebody or a good blow inflicted, and then they don't want to follow it up, and it's infuriating. This fucking DJ didn't have to die. I know this is backtracking a minute, but he takes this big rack of antlers that's mounted on the wall. He takes it off the wall and hits the first slasher with it full on in the face or in the chest or whatever, and a guy goes down. And then he just kind of drops the antlers and goes over to, like, kick the guy. Like, no, fucking, the antlers gave you reach. Why would you ever put, just keep fucking, you know, stab him with the, do whatever you gotta do. Fucking keep your distance, but double, triple, quadruple tap. And then same shit happens here, basically, except Parker doesn't immediately die like DJ did. But it's like, you hit the guy in the face with an oar and you got him on the ground. Hit him again. You killed one. Kill this one. Just keep fucking hitting them. But no, she hits him once and then goes to the end of the dock and detaches part of the dock and starts rowing it out into the middle of the lake.
Well, and it's weird because the movie is all of 80 minutes long, and yet it keeps having to contrive ways of extending itself beyond the duration that it feels like was apportioned to it by fate. It's like it wants to be a short film, It has a short film slightness to it. Even its political bite is sort of short filmy, if that makes sense. You know,
sure.
And you know, it's not long, but it's longer than it, strictly speaking, had to be based on everything, really.
So yeah, how it plays out.
Parker is out on the open water, and the killer lunges out of the water at her like Jason Voorhees, and Parker winds up having to swim for it. She makes it to the opposite shore, and this is the first of the compromised Good Samaritans that shows up. Guy, and you know, this might not be a COVID thing. He might just be kind of a stereotypical horror movie bumpkin.
Yeah, he's not wearing a mask or anything.
Yeah. And, you know, not to stereotype, but he doesn't necessarily look like he belongs to the demographic that would listen to Dr. Fauci. We're trafficking in horror movie cliches here, so I think I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, I think that's okay. And, again, he's not wearing a mask, and at no point in this interaction is he like, oh, well, let me go get my mask, and where's your mask? None of that. It's just he thinks she's an intruder.
Saving that for later.
He just figures she's an intruder, and it takes her a really long time to convince him, like, hey, no, my parents own the house across the lake. You used to take me tubing with your daughter on your boat, whatever. And finally, he's like, oh, okay, well, it's phone's just through here or whatever, and then immediately gets stabbed in the mouth by the second slasher, who we already know is there. We've been allowed to see him. He doesn't come completely out of nowhere. So Parker is on the run again. There's a little bit of an interlude with Miri, who has dragged herself inside. She's got one of those compound leg fractures, bones sticking out. So she's trying to fashion herself a splint. She breaks one of the bar stools and uses an electric carving knife to chop the wood, which I don't think would work. Those things are not robust enough for that, but whatever. She splints the leg, and at one point, the guy who, again, and this speaks to your they're a little too unstoppable beef, the guy whose face emitted a wet crunch, and they signal it by an extended shot of just his body lying there. And then sure enough, he gets one of those last gasp, I'm going to jump on you. And then he gets stabbed in the throat. It's like, just, that didn't do anything. Just leave him dead. It doesn't make any sense for him to still have been alive. And it's completely pointless if you're just going to make him dead for real another 10 seconds later. Just don't do that. It's silly.
Yeah, it's yet more padding in a movie that ought not to have needed any padding at all.
But it's not even effective padding, because again, it doesn't build out another like 3 or 4 minutes worth. It's just another 10 seconds. It's not even useful for that purpose.
Right, it's like getting a package with one packing peanut in it. It's like, this didn't do anything.
No. So Parker is once again fleeing through woods and fields and whatnot, and she gets out to the road, and she's kind of grappling with the slasher who's caught up to her, hits him in the face. We see a car coming from the background up the street. She runs over. There's a woman driving, and this woman is profoundly COVID conscious. Parker is screaming about someone who's trying to kill her, and it's not even one of those situations where the killer is nowhere to be seen, and so the third party has reason to be skeptical or at least confused. No, we can see the fucking guy in the background getting up.
Yeah.
And Parker's got blood on her. We come to find out there's maybe reason why this woman's being more than usually obtuse, but yeah,
it's still annoying in the short term.
Yes. So first she's like scrambling to put on her own mask. And like, hey, where's your mask? And it's like, wait, I might have one. And she pulls out this little baggie. It's like, it's sanitized. She hands it to Parker, and Parker scrambles to put it on her face. Unlock the door. Fucking let me in. As we come to find out, the woman is in league with the slashers because Parker starts feeling a little woozy. And it turns out that the mask is doused in chloroform. So
yeah, I didn't like the way this reveal is deployed, because we can see her go a little cross-eyed and she goes, "This mask smells funny," and you know, she, and then the woman starts to look a little more sinister. What I would have preferred is for a moment of uncertainty as they're just sitting there in the car. And then as the wooziness sets in, maybe the guy comes around to the driver's side window and it becomes clear more gradually that there's an alliance here, that they're previously acquainted. And a moment of that terror, and then the subsequent terror of impending unconsciousness as the chloroform mm-hmm. gets the better of you. It's just a little too rushed and sort of weirdly talky, when it ought to have just played out with looks of dawning realization.
Yeah.
Frankly, yeah. If you've got a mask on, you should be emoting with your eyes anyway. The movie doesn't really lean into that. You know, fucking Dario Argento would have, or Lucio Fulci or whoever would have had an extreme close-up on some terrified eyeballs at this point.
Some bulging eyeballs. Yeah. So Parker wakes up in the cabin mansion. And we meet the second slasher and the woman more properly at this point. First, we find out that the other slasher was their son, so that's why they were really broken up about it. And then it takes, this is another example of, I think, padding in a movie that didn't really need one. This makes me, I just thought of this. You remember we did a movie around, I think, episode 50. It was shortly after we came back from our COVID hiatus. It was like 65 minutes long, that Loose possession movie.
Oh, yeah.
That movie was 65 minutes long. This movie could have been 65 minutes long. It's
well,
nothing.
Right. It, yeah, I mean, I like them lean and mean. But this movie feels, if not bloated, then at least flabby. But it's also, like, leaner than it should be in the ways that matter. You know, like, substance-wise, it's a lot thinner than Lose was.
True. Very true. But anyway, what I was getting at was that this bit, too, seems padded out a little longer than it needs to be. It's just like, okay, why are you here? What's the shtick? And then we see... And we've already seen this before in a different context, but we see this Instagram video of Parker making out with this guy named Benji. Basically, the story about that was she did it purely to make DJ jealous because she's got weird intimacy issues, I guess. And I immediately thought, like, okay, Benji's their son. Did he get COVID and die? And then it takes like 3 to 4 minutes for precisely that to come out.
Yeah, and the only remotely funny part of any of it is the dad indignantly reading hashtags.
It was pretty funny.
Hashtag fuck COVID. Hashtag party, party, whatever. I don't remember.
Hashtag COVID on my face. Hashtag fucked up. You know, it's just...
So that got a titter out of me. But yeah, it is terribly protracted. And, you know, the killer's MO is all to do with contact tracing, as we come to learn. They have hunted her down because she infected and, in their eyes, murdered their son, their other son. And they also killed the guy who gave it to her. Is that right? And that was the guy from the prologue?
Yes.
It's like, well, okay, you're gonna just slash your way back to patient zero? Like, what's the... slash your way to China? I don't understand. Like, why does the chain stop there?
Yeah, it's not
And also,
clear.
Why would you kill Troy, or whatever his name is, first, if you're, like, pursuing the chain? It doesn't make...
Yeah, it's backwards. Exactly. You've done it backwards. Yeah, and you know they break out one of those at-home tests, and this is another example of a COVID anachronism. I guess I don't know this to a 100% certainty, but I would bet a substantial sum that nobody could get hands on like at-home COVID tests in April 2020. Those weren't a thing. You had to, like, go to a drive-thru at a fucking urgent care or some shit. Or a hospital. Or at least a pharmacy.
Yeah, and that was back when they thought they still had to swab the surface of your brain to be sure. really got up in there.
Right, exactly.
It was not a trivial matter to get tested for COVID.
No, but here they are just using, again, one of those at-home ones where you swab the nose and you've got the little cardboard thing. You stick the swab in the hole and then you fold the cardboard shut and you wait 15 minutes. I mean, it's, again, those are ubiquitous now, but they weren't 3 fucking years ago.
If they'd made us wait 15 minutes in real time, that might have been kind of funny. And let's just have to shoot the shit while they wait for the test to come back.
That would have been a slightly bold choice, and I might have been here for it.
A certain amount of suspense if the idea is that it's like a witch trial, and
right.
She's either going to sink or float when they put her in the river. She's going to be executed on the basis of the COVID test. Then you have 15 minutes for the killer and victim to pick each other's brains, and the victim can plead her case, and it's 15 minutes in which Miri could be getting up to something interesting. That happens a little bit here. She's trying to signal the outside world for help, but the dad notices that the Wi-Fi is active.
Which is bullshit. This is another fucking thing. He sees the modem or the router. It's behind some kind of wicker door or something. So he can see lights blinking. He's like, somebody's using the Wi-Fi, or the Wi-Fi is active, or I forget exactly what he says. But, motherfucker, the lights on your router or your modem are always blinking. It's not like you click a link and then if you look at the router at the same time you'll see a light flash. If you send an instant message on Facebook or whatever, and when you hit enter you look over at the router and it blinks. They're just constantly blinking. He wouldn't learn anything from seeing the lights blink. Now, I guess it's possible that he could have that misconception, you know, okay, boomer, as you say, and then that just, like, accidentally ended up being useful, but that's too fucking convoluted for words.
Yeah, no, that's comical, and, you know, yeah, he's just basically standing there saying someone backtraced the emails.
Exactly!
To take it at face value.
The other thing is, she tries to send, like, an iMessage to 911. Does 911 take texts? I mean, I haven't called 911 very many times in my life, but it's never occurred to me to do anything other than just call them on the phone. I don't know that they take texts. I mean, it all comes to nothing because the message comes up as failed to deliver or whatever, so it doesn't really matter, but just another bit of a head scratcher. Ultimately, after a lot of futzing back and forth, I guess they realize that Miri's not dead. The dude, the father, runs out looking for her, which allows Miri to get the drop on the mom while she's concentrated on Parker. Hits her over the head with a wine bottle, and then they shove her through a glass door, and so she's down for the count for the moment.
And the mother's last words before that fracas ensues is to do with how she's planning to torch the cabin to eliminate the evidence of a break-in and a series of murders, which, or at least, you know, fingerprints and shit like that, because Parker is asking her how she expects to get away with it. I thought, as grief-stricken parents, maybe they didn't plan to get away with it. And that's kind of a scary notion, but apparently she intends to get off scot-free.
I think that would have been better, especially considering, you know, fucking, even a burned corpse, a coroner doing an autopsy, would be like, there are fucking, you know, like, there's evidence of stab wounds here. There's fucking knife gouges on bone or what. I mean, you don't commit murder with blunt force or stabbing trauma and then just burn the corpses and get away, unless you, like, put them in a crematorium and turn them into ashes. That's the only way that burning a stabbed or battered corpse hides the evidence.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning, too, just because it portends in kind of a heavy-handed way the mother slasher's ultimate fate, which is only a few minutes out at this point. Although the dad bites the dust first, he is pushed from a height onto the antlers from the first slasher duel in the movie. So that's also worth mentioning, I suppose. That's why the antlers had to be where they are in order for him to land on them.
Right. So Parker and Miri wander off. It's not immediately clear where they're going, but they get out to this sort of barn where there's an ATV. So I guess that's what they're going to use to drive off. I don't know why they didn't just try taking the slasher mobile, but whatever. As they're trying to get it to start, apparently the battery's good, but maybe it's out of gas. Parker grabs a gas can, and then Mama Slasher shows up with an axe. And Parker blocks a few blows with the plastic gas can, and so this ends up putting some gas on the slasher woman, and ultimately they light her on fire.
No evidence. No way exactly. To be sure.
No way to be sure. So she fails to stop, drop, and roll, and instead just runs screaming out to the road and then up the road a little ways and collapses. Parker and Miri hobble out. The cops show up, and that's it. Roll credits and more after the break.
Miri.
Jump in, water's fine.
Who is this?
I don't know.
That's creepy, Parker.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Help me!
Oh my God!
Just one moment.
Unlock the door!
You have a mask, don't you? Your mask.
What?
I can't let you in. It's not safe.
Are you kidding me, lady? Please!
And we're back. So, I think it's relatively clear from some of the adjectives we were throwing around during the synopsis that I don't think either one of us was super enthused about this movie. I ended up liking it a little better by the end than I thought I was going to, back when it was just one slasher that had no personality.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I still didn't really care for it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the personality or personalities that ultimately emerged didn't do much for me by way of a chaser. And I was thinking about this while the credits were rolling and afterward. I've seen this movie complained about on the basis of its politics, you know, and I think that's almost describing too much significance to it, because the killers are incidentally contact tracing Fauci freaks who are like way overzealous about, you know, like in a murderous rage about keeping everybody 6 feet apart. And that's stupid. However, COVID stuff is just so played out and run into the fucking ground at this point that even if the movie had taken the exact opposite tack and the killers had been like QAnon crazoids, I think I might have found it just as fatiguing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I either way, it's just part of the same fucking noise that we had to put up with for several years. So I don't know. I'm not to say that you can't make a good COVID movie, but you are depicting recent history. And so I think you've got to have a fresh take and some kind of insight or some kind of angle on it. And that's tough because we all went a little stir crazy and we've all been inundated with it. And we've all had time, ample time, to consider it from a lot of different angles. You know, I've gone through periods where I thought people weren't taking it seriously enough, periods where I thought people were taking it too seriously. There's a lot of room for that kind of fluctuation just in my own attitudes, depending on what month of which year we're talking about. And so when you've gone through the whole gamut like that in real life, only a very good movie could tell you something you didn't already know, or make you feel something you hadn't already felt. It's not the kind of trauma that can be tapped into in a way that gets the fear glands producing their sweet fear nectar. You know, because it's just too ho-hum somehow, even with upwards of a million deaths. You know, I don't mean to be glib, but it for most of us, it was a period of just stifling boredom mixed with helplessness and no small amount of irritation at the dumb fuck discourse that was constantly
right,
you know, that the air was always buzzing with. And this is just kind of more of the same. It's just a little bit dumb and necessarily late to the party, because, you know, someone had to write it in response to COVID, so it couldn't come out when any of this was super topical. One movie that I do remember coming out and striking some people as fresh just because it was not late to the party was Host, which we never reviewed. It's less than an hour long, which I feel like this movie probably ought to have been. I didn't particularly care for Host, but it was really well received for some reason. And
yeah,
it's funny, there's a meme, there's an article that's been circulating on Twitter the last week or so. Something like, study finds that mental health impact of pandemic was minimal.
Relatively minimal, yeah.
Everyone is dunking on this with like, well, here's the crazy thing that I did, you know, for much of 2020. Here's how my mental health was adversely affected. So it's been ratioed into infinity. My thinking on that is, look no further than the movie Host debuting to rapturous thunderous applause because we were all bored out of our fucking skulls in early to mid 2020 or whenever it dropped. You know, the fact that that movie got the reception it got is all the proof you could ever need that as a society we're not all together well psychologically.
Well, I mean, for shit's sake, this fucking movie has, I think, an 86% tomato meter and a 62 Metascore.
I mean,
this movie got relatively positive reception, which is ultimately a substantial part of the reason why we're even doing this fucking episode. The critical response seemed fairly favorable. I'm like, oh, well, it was co-written by the guy who created Scream with Wes Craven. You know, maybe there's something here. And as it turns out, no, not really. But you're never going to be able to ultimately explain why people latch onto certain things. We've done, I wouldn't say a ton, because ultimately a lot of the movies we've done are bad and everybody kind of knows they're bad. But there have been a fair number of examples of movies that are, if not critically acclaimed, at least critically well-received generally, and relatively popular on a commercial audience level, whatever, and we just can't figure out why.
Well, I posited,
Smile is a relatively recent example.
Megan.
Let's.
Well, I posited
that one's
on
too
Twitter.
Fresh. I don't want to.
It was fresh on the goddamn tomatometer, inconceivably.
Yeah, well, the other kind of fresh. I don't want to talk about it too much.
I posited on Twitter that we are perceived as living in a horror movie renaissance, you know, because a few high-profile art house horror movies came along coming up on a decade ago, you know, starting in like 2014, 15, 16. And we got a few really standout horror movies a year for several years, enough to make it a trend, and then God help us, someone thinks to call it elevated horror, and then it's a brand in addition to being a brand. Yeah, no thank you. And now every middling horror movie that comes along is entering a climate of pre-existing goodwill, I think.
Yeah.
And
I
so
think
we're grading on
you're
a
absolutely
curve
right
in the opposite direction. That historically, horror movies have been graded on a curve curved the other way. And all of a sudden, a lot of horror movies that I think would have been rotten 10 years ago are getting like mid-80s to low 90s on the old. And the tomatometer is not the be-all and end-all. Obviously, the fact that I even pronounce it that way is indicative of the fact that I don't take it that seriously. But I treat it like a Star Trek gadget.
Right. Well, but the flip side is, if that's not your review aggregator of choice, I tend to think that Metacritic is a little bit more representative, simply because...
It's the snootier of the two. It's more exacting.
Well, exactly. It's more exacting, whereas the tomato meter depends on binary choices, and people on Twitter and elsewhere have done whole screenshots of, like, look at this really not very positive review that they slapped a fresh tomato on. What the fuck is this? Whereas Metacritic just takes the reviews and normalizes them to a score out of 100 and then averages them all out. That's going to be more accurate. So you can take that. And again, this movie got a 62 on Metacritic, which means positive. You know, it's a green on their scale. It's not acclaimed green. It's not in the 80s or 90s or whatever. But those are pretty good reviews for a movie that really doesn't have that much going for it, ultimately.
I think that the whole middle stretch, for me, got really boring. All of the running around like chickens with their heads cut off. And I find that sort of thing exciting in the Scream films, in the first Scream in particular, because it happens in fits and starts, and it can just swoop down on you out of nowhere. Because that movie is, of course, very dialogue-heavy, lots of quips flying back and forth. But all of the fun and games can end at a moment's notice, you know, and Ghostface can just round the corner, knife drawn, and hack you to pieces. Here, it is practically a silent film for long stretches, and that can be fun. You know, I like it when a horror movie is just balls-to-the-wall horror for an extended period of time, or when an action movie has, like, upwards of half an hour of just straight action, and it finds a way to sustain the momentum somehow. Here, there wasn't much momentum to speak of, I found, and I think part of the issue is that the slashers don't have any personality. We've harped on about this plenty at this point. And when the personality does show up, for me at least, it was just kind of grating.
It reminded me of the phenomenon with The Hunt, where there was a certain amount of expectation on, I think, our part, and also on the part of a certain former president, apparently, that
45.
that it was going to be very hostile to red staters, I guess, or his base, or however you want to phrase it. And as we kind of came to conclude, you in particular, it's really very much the opposite. So I thought about that in terms of kind of fitting a movie onto that spectrum, and with these slashers being kind of, I guess, caricatures of overcautious COVID obsessives, this movie could be read as falling into that same kind of political niche.
The same kind of bait and switch.
Right. And you were talking about how the film's politics have been criticized somewhat. I haven't followed any of that, quite frankly. I don't care. I'm sure you don't either, but you just have to come across it.
You know, if the politics had run exactly counter to the way they currently do, I likely would have found that just as played out and obnoxious.
Right. I guess what I'm building toward is, I think this movie, there's a little bit more room, and I don't know Kevin Williamson. I don't know what his politics are. He might be a nutball anti-vaxxer of the highest order. I really have no idea, but without any knowledge one way or another on that front, I see more room to potentially give him the benefit of the doubt that he just picked a goofy caricature without any particular political axe to grind. He's just like, wouldn't it be funny if people were so nutso about COVID protections and the risks of COVID that one of their kids died from COVID and they took murderous revenge.
Yeah, and the answer is no, not particularly.
it's not especially funny. Not so much. Whereas with The Hunt, there's no, I guess, spinning that in a more positive light. It really is just pretty retrograde.
Well, so my problem with the movie's middle stretch being monotonous and my problem with the reveal at the end being silly and also feeling like a waste of time, albeit less of one, is I think it might be possible to redress both of those wrongs at the same time, and you would do it by pulling a Barbarian. This is my proposed fix. Now, this movie and Barbarian are slightly too contemporaneous for the makers of Sick to have copied Barbarian. Barbarian isn't even the first movie to do what it does. It just does it in a very striking way, where there's the passing of the baton at more or less the exact midpoint. I was not big on the second half of Barbarian. However, I do like the changeover. I particularly like the "who the fuck is this" moment when Justin Long is introduced. I think that if the first half of this movie had been slasher action with a faceless, personality-less villain, and then we had cut away at a critical juncture of some kind, a cliffhanger, before the slashing gets to be too boring and long in the tooth, and when we had cut away to some middle-aged woman or man or both who we'd never seen before, then we get our "who the fuck are they" moment, and it's gradually revealed that these are the people who are behind the slashing, and they are doing it. You know, maybe we watch the plan being concocted. First of all, I think it would work better with just one of them. A man and a woman, husband and wife. For some reason, watching the two of them riff on each other made everything feel less plausible and in a way less funny. I think it's kind of creepier and potentially even funnier and certainly more plausible if it's like a single mom or something who already had a weird relationship with her son and then he dies because he went to a COVID party, and that pushes her off the deep end. You know, a husband and wife, obviously it's a horrible tragedy and it frequently shatters marriages, but you're sort of supposed to help keep each other sane in the aftermath of losing a child. Not to say that you couldn't both go off the deep end together, but I feel like if it were just a single parent, single mother, single father, what have you, then it would be a little more credible, and we could watch in the back half of the movie, or at least for a protracted flashback in the middle, their sort of descent into slasherhood. This was the alternate universe version of Sick that I was concocting while the finale was playing out in front of my eyes. I just thought that if we'd gotten to know these people a little better in kind of a mundane way, watched them looking at Instagram, putting the pieces together, putting a plan together, then maybe the finale would have meant something, and we wouldn't have had to get those long-winded monologues, which I know are a staple of the Scream franchise, although, hot take, I don't think that any of them do that particularly well after the first one, which is superlative.
Right. I don't necessarily feel strongly in that direction, but on the other hand, I've watched the first Scream multiple times. I don't think I've seen Screams 2 through 5 more than once, possibly twice. So, yeah. And it's been a while, so I really can't come down that hard one way or another.
I have seen the whole series now. Somewhat hilariously, I had only seen the first one when we reviewed the fifth one. So I was kind of talking out of my ass, but I did my damn homework in anticipation of, wait, no, do I have that wrong? I don't remember. I might have watched all of them in the build up to that. That doesn't matter. In any case,
you're prepped for our next episode.
Yes. So. Stay tuned.
But yeah, the only thing that taking that route might have ruined is any kind of surprise or shock at the big reveal at the end, except as it is, there's no sort of gasp moment, because it's just like, okay, so it's a middle-aged married couple, okay, and then as soon as you see the Instagram post, it's not like, oh my god, they're Benji's parents. It's, oh, they're Benji's parents. Okay, how long is it going to take for us to actually come out and say that? Oh, a long time. Okay, great. You know, so, yeah, I think your fix might have been just the thing. Now, it might still not have really done much to build it out, particularly depending on how it was handled, but I think it would have given things a shot anyway.
So, in that spirit, I'm going to recommend, I mean, there are several more kind of highbrow, emotionally searing sorts of dramas that come to mind when you think of movies about grieving parents who resort to violence in order to have justice. In the Bedroom is a great movie about just such an event. The Son, the Dardenne brothers film, also great, but those aren't horror movies by any stretch, horrific as they may be. But nonetheless, I'm looking for a little bit more of that in the back half of this, and it's a big shakeup, and it would get you out of slasher territory. And so if that's what you tuned in for, then the movie would not be to your liking. I just thought that it was totally lacking in heft, and I don't even really need pathos per se, just some sense of psychological nuance is even too strong a word. I guess the killers are caricatured to the extent that they're just kind of, I don't know, impossible to be scared of. And
right,
there are lines, you know, I mean, the gold standard is the end of the first screen when Matthew Lillard is like, you know, my mom and dad are going to be so mad at me. And then, you know, he gets hit with the phone and he's like, oh, fuck. It's goofy as hell, but also has that kind of Columbine-y evil to it that feels very real. And there's none of that here. And I'm not even looking for that level of gravitas, because I don't expect every new slasher movie that comes along to be as good as Scream or even half as good. But boy howdy, you know, I feel like I've talked about this relatively recently. I wish that movies would just aim a little higher, because even if you fall well short of Scream or In the Bedroom or The Son or whatever the fuck, you're still going to, at worst, you'll be a noble failure.
Right.
I feel like a lot of these horror movies that are debuting to positive Tomatometer scores aren't even aspiring to anything particularly. They're just kind of competent and workmanlike. And sometimes I respond to that, but not if bad writing interferes with it. I feel like that's one thing that I'm especially sensitive to, and that's what kind of hamstrings this movie. So I'm pointing to very arty recommendations here, but it's kind of because, it's not because I want Sick to be that. I just think that you need a little bit more of that in your DNA in order to, I don't know, speak to me personally. In terms of the like paranoia and loneliness and just the general malaise that COVID inspired, that sort of thing has never been done better than The Conversation, the Coppola film. I wish that, and I thought this right from the beginning, you know, right from the prologue in the grocery store with the woman's voice talking about protocols that have to be adhered to. It's like he's wandering around City 17. I just knew right away, oh, this movie doesn't really get COVID. It's not going to actually evoke what that period was like. I wished that character, Troy, I think was the name, or who knows, I wish that he had been menaced in a more low-key sort of way, and he was just a little bit jumpy in the way that everyone was a little bit jumpy doing their grocery shopping those first few months. That intro could have been twice as long, or, you know, like 150% as long, and it would have been possibly better if it had been more of a slow burn, I think, less of the usual taunting slasher theatrics. A movie that does that well, which I think I've recommended before, is Entrance. Now, that's an extreme slow burn because it's like a feature length slow burn. And then it becomes a slasher bloodbath right at the very end. Again, not expecting Sick to be that, but just, I don't know, aim a little higher. There's a line that a professor trotted out once in like an undergraduate creative writing class that I took, It was a maxim or a mantra, and I don't remember who she attributed it to, but the line goes, revise towards strangeness. When in doubt, they go, sand off the stuff that you've seen before and try to just nudge it in the direction. The word I'm always using is singular. I've tried to expunge it from my vocabulary just because occasionally even I get bored of hearing myself talk. But, sounding like a broken record. But Sick, like a lot of horror movies that were well received, which did nothing for me, that we've seen lately, I think needed to revise towards strangeness a little more, which is why I'm going a little bit out on a limb with my random grab bag of highfalutin recommendations.
Highfalutin non-horror recommendations.
Yeah, quite right.
Yeah. Speaking of sanding off things that you've seen before, not that this is any kind of big deal, but I did audibly groan near the beginning of the film because when Parker and Miri are headed to the palace cabin, once again, we get the overhead shot of the car driving down a two-lane road through some fucking trees. It's a goddamn plague.
Yeah, it might as well just be Jack Torrance and his yellow Volkswagen or whatever it is. Brom, 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 brom. Yeah,
I would have had more respect for this film if they had just used archive footage from the opening of the show inexplicably. Like, nobody's driving a car that actually looks like that, but they just fucking dropped it in there anyway. But, yeah, no, just once again, we get to watch a car drive through some trees. We don't need to see that ever again. Ever again. I don't like to be categorical about something like that, but I'm basically there. Like, I don't think we need it anymore. And relative to what you were saying about slasher movies these days, often aiming more for sort of workmanlike competence, I agree with you that sometimes that is appealing, but I think it's more likely to be appealing if the movie has other things to recommend it. And what I mean specifically is, fucking gore, for one thing.
Oh, for sure.
A couple of good fucking jump scares. And in order to do that, you have to have a body count. And this movie isn't built for one because there's only four fucking teenagers or college students, whatever. So maybe they're 20. Who gives a shit?
Yeah. R.I.P. DJ, gone but not forgotten.
Fucking DJ and what's his name, Tyler or whatever the fuck. That's it. And then obviously all the more fucking slashers die than protagonists.
Yeah, their KD ratio is
very poor. But yeah, when DJ does get, when the impalement is completed and it gets punched all the way through the front of him, I did go, oh damn. Like that was a decent bit of blood spatter gore type stuff, but that's basically the only one. It didn't really do anything for me when the dad fell on the antlers, even though he's impaled in like three places. Maybe it's just because we just kind of see antlers poking through like a black sweater.
Right.
We see a little blood. But yeah, if you're trying to harken back to the 80s where they were just pumping out like 30 fucking slasher films every summer, it seems like. And you go back to so many of those, and they're like, yeah, they're not really doing anything, but a lot of them, they got a few good kills, and there's enough sort of gushy pleasures in there that you're like, I'll spend 84 minutes watching this fucking thing and not regret it.
Gimmick, or at least a mask that's worth a damn.
Yeah, if you want to harken back to that, you have to do some of those things. And this movie is in this sort of weird no man's land between something more highfalutin like The Rental, let's say, to bring that up again, which isn't even that highfalutin, I'd say.
No.
But it's a little more stylish. It's a little more, looks a little prettier, that sort of thing.
Got a good mask, and it's a slow burn. And it's got some of that Scream sort of, it's all fun and games until it isn't attitude.
Right.
Where it keeps you sort of off kilter.
Yeah. This movie is kind of stuck in a no man's land between that and 80s gushiness, where it's a lot of fucking mood lighting, and then there's like slow motion dance party aesthetics that are dropped into the movie for no particular reason in the middle. But it also doesn't have any good gore to speak of, except, like I said, the one time. So just kind of stuck in the middle there. But anyway, we're supposed to be doing recommendations, so I guess I'll get on with that. I'm going to give a legitimate recommendation and then a stupid one. The legitimate recommendation is a film you already mentioned in passing. I'm going to recommend Hush from 2016. I may have recommended it before, but fuck it. We've been doing recommendations for nearly 100 episodes now. I can't be sure I'm coming up with a brand new recommendation every time, because for as many horror movies as we've watched, there's still only so many good ones. There's only so many that I really feel like recommending. So this film, it's a Mike Flanagan film. Longtime listeners to the podcast know that we are generally positively disposed toward Mike Flanagan. Our only real beef with him is that he sometimes gets a little mushy at the end. But that doesn't really happen, from what I can recall, in Hush. So that's a plus. It's about an author who is deaf, and she is out in a house all alone in the middle of the woods, and she's there to work. She's there to write. And there's an intruder. He's trying to get into the house and do God knows what. And a lot of the suspense is derived from the fact that the guy doesn't have to necessarily be quiet when he's making his way around. The lead's played by Kate Siegel, Flanagan's longtime collaborator and now wife. She's very good. Movie in general is quite enjoyable. The idiotic recommendation I'm going to make is on the basis of what you were touching on a little bit, Matt, in terms of, I guess, families reacting poorly to family trauma or a death in the family or what have you. In this case, and this is a spoiler for the film I'm going to recommend, which is I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. But
I was trying to remember that line the other day.
I'm going to deploy it here, so
okay.
Fear not. It's in the opposite direction from Sick. Parents snapping due to the death of a child and seeking revenge. In I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, the villain is the son of the villain from the first film. In the first film, the collection of pretty 90s 20-somethings who were pretending to be teenagers, they run over a guy on the road, and he's some kind of fisherman or something. And so this apparition, I mean, he's not literally a ghost, but this guy sort of comes back, and his weapon is a hook, you know, like a fish hook, like a big one. One that you would use to maneuver a net full of fish, as opposed to one you'd put on the end of a line to fish off the end of a dock or whatever.
This shroud-like rain slicker.
Yeah.
I've still only seen I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. I have not seen the first one, and that is entirely the caprice of... that's entirely the doing of my co-host.
Yeah, well, I guess all I would say to that is that you are seeing them in the order that I did, assuming that at some point you watched the original, because I saw the second one first.
Okay, all right, Dad. That's how my pa watched them, and his father before him. I didn't know it was a fucking time-honored tradition.
No, it's not. I'm just making excuses. It seemed the most convenient one available.
Yeah, well, when they put out an I'm sure astonishingly bad legacy sequel to I Know What You Did Last Summer, then maybe I'll have the impetus I need to go back and actually watch the first outing.
Yeah. Anyway, as I said, the villain in the sequel, which is the film I am ironically recommending, is the son of aforementioned hook hand guy whose name was apparently Ben something. I don't remember what the last name is, but
Ben, that's right.
Yes. So Jennifer Love Hewitt is the lead, but she has this love interest who's really only the beginning of the movie and then at the end, and his name is Will Benson, and it turns out that he is also the villain. And the line that you were talking about earlier is, Benson, Ben's son. Like, apparently this was his goofy little jape to himself.
Boy, won't they feel foolish.
his nom de plume.
Yes.
But the reason I am ironically recommending I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, and this is the context in which I got Matt to watch it in the first place, is that it's just a delightful amalgam of all the 90s slasher tropes you could ever want. It's just really goofy. Obviously, that line is a particular standout. And I also appreciated, although I came to find out that I didn't have this 100% right, but for a long time I appreciated the fact that it not only does the black member of the group of protagonists die first, that's Mekhi Phifer, but also the first person to die is a black member of, like, the resort staff. So they do it not once, but twice. Mm-hmm. I later found out that the first time I watched the movie, I missed the scene where this stoner radio host guy, played incidentally by Jack Black, mm-hmm. is actually...
That was the only thing that I knew about I Still Know What You Did Last Summer going in, because I caught a little bit of it on TV when I was a kid, or when I was younger, in any case. And I remembered thinking, is that Jack Black? Sure enough, the one and only. The slasher movies since the 90s have lost this archetypal comic relief. We don't get, like, goofy comic relief guys anymore like we used to. I think that characters like that were always hit and miss, but they did hit sometimes. You know, you
don't have right.
You don't have to take it out behind the shed and shoot it in the head just yet. You know, it's like Jack Black in I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, or fucking LL Cool J in Deep Blue Sea. It's like these movies are missing a key component, an essential ingredient. It's not as disposable as it would appear. You gotta have the fucking comedy mask and the drama mask, you know, above your theater stage.
We were talking about this, I think it was just last episode, when I was recommending Cabin in the Woods. The comic relief guy makes it to the end. You know,
yes.
Nemo, man, you gotta wake up. This shit is topsy-turvy. That guy makes it to the end, and he's a classic comic. He's a fucking stoner. And, you know, he checks so many of the boxes.
Yeah.
And he's not the best part, because as we said, and this is 100% true, Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins are the best part of that film. But he's one of the best parts. But anyway, yeah, so as it turns out, Jack Black dies first, and I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. So it didn't hit that trope quite as hard as I thought. But yeah, it's not a good movie, which again is why the recommendation is not serious. But I am amused almost to no end by that film and just how goofy it is. So take that for what it's worth.
I think DJ is supposed to be the that guy of this movie, but filmmakers these days are afraid to go as broad with it as movies like this used to go.
And not to mention, if that's the case, he's trying to fill too many trope roles at once, because he is simultaneously the lover slash jilted lover who's not a villain but is still an irritant to the protagonist or whatever, or, you know, a plot point.
The stock shitheel boyfriend of 2020s horror movies, yeah.
But also he's maybe the comic relief. And yeah, I don't think he really...
And also a bit of a red herring.
Yeah, and he doesn't really check any one of those three boxes in any kind of real way. He's too much of a soft boy to be the true shit heel and, like, the malignant mold, let's say. And he's not funny enough to be the comic relief guy. And he's a red herring for all of 2 minutes. So, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, this podcast is already substantially longer than the film, even including the end credits. So I think we ought to wrap up here. But until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Jarendaisy.
and we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Sick Official Trailer Peacock Original, uploaded by Peacock. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, March 26th, and we will be desperately hoping that Scream 6 turns out better than Scream 5 did. See you then.